slides you wrote that you do the difference between the PV of...
Yeah, you spend $600 million 1 year and you save something else later on. Think through it. It's a present value of a timing difference. You spend $600 million in your 5 or 6 or
that's
whatever.
That's going in your cash flow.
It's going in your cash flow.
Right.
But you save something else down the road. That's what you have to bring into the cash flows. Right?
Hi, Professor.
Yes.
We have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
One's like derived from the fact that we've got a really big expected return on capital. It's around 20%, which I think is ridiculous, given the hurdle rate that we calculated.
How do you know it's ridiculous?
It just seems too big. I mean,
relative to what?
The hurdle.
What's the average return on capital of companies in the entertainment business?
What's that?
What's the average return on capital of companies in the entertainment business?
I didn't actually check that.
You can't say words like ridiculous.
Okay.
Don't make sense,
okay,
right?
Like, so you that's guys, actually something I should look
yeah,
at.
Yeah.
But, like, okay, I'll check that.
And then in terms of the
no, that doesn't include subscriptions.
Okay, so it's that 8%, and then the studio subscriptions.
They're two separate subscription services.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And the last question is the side benefits.
Mm-hmm.
In the slides, it said the side benefits should contribute to their earnings.
Can you do a return on capital?
Yeah.
It is earnings, yeah.
So I should include it as like an anti-expense?
First, let me ask you, are you making a decision based on return on capital?
No.
Then why are you worrying so much about it? If it's not driving your decision, what does it matter whether it's 18 or 20 or 23%?
I feel like, is there a right answer that we...
There's a right decision.
The right decision.
You know, accounting return on capital is going to be driven by accounting choices. So if I used accelerated depreciation, my return on capital would be 25% rather than 20%. It doesn't make the project any better or worse.
Okay, so the decision is ultimately the rating criteria.
If you're not going to base it on return on capital, why does it matter what those judgments you make to get to return on capital are? I mean, they're all legitimate judgments. They're all defensible judgments. But you're not basing a decision on it anyway. So why waste your time on it?
Okay.
As simple as that.
Yeah. We do have a positive NPV, too. So I guess that'll be it.
But that has nothing to do with the accounting return on capital,
that's
right?
Like, that's like the next step after that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for
having
us.
Okay. You're welcome. Got my email yesterday, right? So if you get the numbers nailed down, I mean, obviously the project report is not due till 10:30 Wednesday, right? 10:30, not 3:30, but 10:30. So it's got to come in before 10:30 on Wednesday. But if you have the numbers at some point in time before 10:30, obviously on Wednesday, put it into that little Excel spreadsheet. I'm asking for four numbers. What's your return on capital? What's your cost of capital? What's your NPV? 10-year life, NPV longer life. And the reason is when I come into class on Wednesday, I want you to be able to see what the distribution is of numbers that you came up with. Okay? And the reason is very simple. I've had, you know, over the weekend, I got about 250 emails about the case. Some big questions, some small questions, some fair questions, some not so fair. Okay? I mean, questions like, you know, what do I do about, you know, how do... About half the questions, though, were accounting related. Should I have a depreciation on the server? If you capitalize it, do you have to depreciate it? No. Should I allocate an expense? Do whatever you want. But here's the point I want you to remember. What's the end game here? What do I want you to make a decision on? should you build the damn studio? That's it. Everything else is a means to an end. So while you're spending hours coming up with an accounting earnings and an accounting return on capital, here's my question for you. Is your decision being based on the return on capital? If your answer is yes, spend all the time you need to getting it finessed to the point where you're comfortable with it. If it's not going to be based on the accounting return on capital, just get it done and move on. Allocating, depreciating might change it, but if you're not basing your decision on it, why are you wasting your time there? So spend your time where it's most useful. Okay? That's the first thing. The second is, as part of the case, I ask you to do some what-if questions, and of course, big set of emails, or large set of emails came in saying, which one should I ask the what-if question on? How many what-ifs should I ask? I want you to ask what-if questions. Why? Because I want to see more tables? Are you crazy? I'll have enough numbers already to deal with. What I want you to ask what-if questions on is so that you get more comfortable with your decision. So when you ask a what-if question, here's what I want you to focus on. Whatever you get as your numbers in that what-if, ask, what I want to know is, did this change your decision? Did it make your decision stronger or weaker? That's why you ask what-if questions. So if you ask, how many what-if questions do I need to ask? If after the first question you feel pretty sure that this is the project to take, you're done. If after the first question you're really confused, then ask a second question. If you get even more confused, my suggestion is stop right there. Because this process is not playing out the way you want it to play out. You're supposed to converge on a decision. So keep your focus on that end game, which is, this is about deciding whether to invest or not. Also, please, when you send your final project report, put that, I think it's studying the studio is what I wanted to put in the subject. It's not because I'm some anally retentive person who wants this. Tomorrow morning at 10:30, if I combine this class with my corporate finance class and you're both submitting your cases at the same time, they have the same case, incidentally. That's why you need to give it in by 10:30, because I'm going to do it in class in the morning there. So if you want an advance notice, you can actually show up in that class and sit through that class, because we'll do the case. I will have probably 170 project submissions, and I'm afraid I will lose quite a few of them if I don't have. So the reason I do that is I create a smart mailbox where all your, otherwise I'll have this mix. I don't know what's under, you know, which comes from this class, which comes from the MBA class. It's a huge nightmare for me. So please do follow the studying the studio. Put it in the subject, because then it automatically goes into that particular folder rather than into my general mailbox, and makes it easier for me to organize stuff. So any questions before I start? Okay. One final thing, and this is it's a little unfair, but because it seems like I'm going to be piling on. You know what's coming next Monday? The quiz. The second quiz. There's no rest for the wicked. I'm sorry. This is the way it is. That said, I have some good news. We're going to finish the material for the second quiz today. And almost everything on the second quiz is something you dealt with on your case. So if you were involved actively in this case analysis, you've actually started preparing for the second quiz in ways you didn't even realize you were preparing. So that's the good news. The bad news is there is a quiz next Monday at 3:30. Okay, so let's pick up where we left off and have some really good news. What we're going to do today has absolutely nothing to do with the case. So don't try to bring all this stuff into the case, please. It has nothing to do with your case. So here's the first thing I want to talk about. We were talking about side costs and side benefits in the last session, and we talked about excess capacity and land that you'd never use for. I want to talk about one final side cost. It's called product cannibalization. I'll give you an example. I remember that Starbucks opened across the street from here. It opened after, the first one that opened was actually the Broadway one. Right? That's been around about 10 years. So let's assume you had been the project analyst looking at this new Starbucks. So I ask you, is this a good project? How do you estimate whether it's a good project? What are you going to do? You're going to project the revenues at the Starbucks, subtract out the expenses, come up with the cash flows. Take the present value of the cash flows and tell me whether the net present value of this new store is positive or not. You know the biggest problem you'd have faced is? when you opened that new Starbucks and you had revenues from people coming into that Starbucks, some of those people would have gone into the Starbucks on Broadway were now coming here because it's more convenient, right? Let's assume 25% of your sales is coming from your own stores. It's just people moving from one store to another. You see the danger you face when you make investments? Because some of those revenues are going to be there anyway. And by counting them as revenues for this store, you're going to open too many stores. Maybe that's how Starbucks ended up with 170 stores just in New York. Okay. So I want to talk about this idea of product cannibalization and what to do about it. And let me use the projects we've described to kind of explain this. Let's take the Rio Disney theme park. Right? I gave you revenues and the number of people coming to the theme park. Let's assume I told you that 20% of the revenues at Rio Disney is coming from people who would have gone to Disney World or Disneyland anyway. These are Brazilians who would have flown out to, and now that you have a Rio Disney, they're coming to Rio Disney now. So I have a very simple practical question. It's all about incremental, right? Incremental revenues, incremental cash flows. So when I look at this theme park and I project out the revenues and the cash flows in this theme park, should I count only the incremental revenues, which will be the 80% of the revenues of new people that I'm pulling in, should I count in all my revenues or should I choose some number in the middle? You see my question? If I count all the revenues, I'll have big cash flows. If I count only 80% of the revenues, I'll have smaller cash flows. Should I be counting all of the revenues or only 80%? What do you think? Okay, that's a good question. So you're saying there might be other revenues, but let's forget the other revenues. Counting just the theme park revenues, you're saying it should only be the 80%, right? Holding all else constant, that'll make it less likely that I open the theme park. Let's assume the net present value goes from positive to negative. I don't open the theme park. Now, let's tell me the biggest danger I face is Disney. Who are those 20% who switched? They were Brazilians who said, this is more convenient to have a theme park just in our backyard. So rather than fly all the way to Orlando, we can fly to Rio and go to the theme park, right? So it's convenience that drew them here. You've decided not to open the theme park. Could Universal step into that void? Maybe they can open a theme park in Rio, and maybe everybody won't come there. Because let's face it, if you promise your kid that you're going to see Mickey, and you take him to a Universal theme park and say, Woody Woodpecker, that looks a lot like Mickey. It's not going to fly, right? I mean, so in a sense, one of the advantages that Disney has is it's got the barrier to enter, the competitive advantages. But maybe 5% or 6% of that 20% say, you know what, this is not as good as going to a Disney theme park, but it's so much more convenient. Therefore, I'm going to just go to Universal instead. So here are the three possible answers. The first is, if that 20% would all have gone to Universal, in other words, they're not attached to Disney, then you're going to have to count all of the revenues. If they're all going to stay with you no matter what, then you count only 80%. So because you can then assume that they will go. But if you think that some of them will leave and go to another theme park, maybe you'll end up using some number between the 100 and the 80%. How much will depend on what you know about your customers and whether they're going to stick with you. This is actually a huge issue with pharmaceutical companies. I'll tell you why. Let's assume Glaxo, I think at one point in time, owned Xanax when it was, the first ulcer drug. I forget which one it was, which dominated the market. They had the ulcer drug, had 80% of the market, with a patent protection. Let's assume that within Glaxo, you've now come up with a better ulcer drug. You already own the market, right? If you introduce that new ulcer drug, much of your revenues are going to come from your own drug. That's product cannibalization. Companies face this all the time. It's not just consumer product companies. Any company that introduces a new product has to factor this in. Okay. So in the case of Rio Disney, there is a case to be made. Just focus on the incremental revenues. These customers, we own them. They're not going anywhere else. But let me give you another scenario. Let's assume you have a new Disney cable show. It's a Saturday show. And it's expected to attract 20% of its viewers from ABC, which is also owned by Disney. They say, I'm not going to take this over because there's too much cannibalization. Here you got to be a lot more careful because that 20%, not that happy with the other show anyway, they might go to a competitor. It's better to cannibalize yourself than have a competitor cannibalize you. So when you look at product cannibalization, that's a question you're asking, is if I don't take this project, where will these customers, the 20%, go? Will they stay with me? If the answer is yes, then count only the incremental portion. If the answer is no, you have to be a lot more careful. Any questions about product cannibalization? I actually considered, in the Netflix case, throwing in a product cannibalization. You know what form it would have taken, right? Remember the studio subscribers? If I said they were pulling from regular subscribers, you'd have had to deal with the product cannibalization there. But I decided you had enough twists in the case to begin with. I don't want to add that on. But this is something that's in the background with almost every big decision that companies make. Now let's talk about synergies. The essence of synergy is you're able to do something that you could not have done as independent entities. So in the case of Disney, I mean, you could see the synergy, especially in the context of, I use the example of Star Wars. You produce the movie, then you have the toys and the games and the all the stuff that comes out of it. And the Star Wars attraction they're going to build in California Adventure, pulling in more people. That's synergy. And in most project analyses, synergy is left as this diffuse item that shows up at the very last stage in the process. This is the stage where you've worked through the numbers and you've concluded this project doesn't make sense. But somebody says, but we could sell toys, it'll make up the difference. We could produce these TV shows, they'll make up the difference. And that's what I want to fight against. If there's synergy, I want you to be specific about it and bring it into the cash flows. So let's do a couple of examples. Let's go back to that Bookscape example. We've already looked at adding a Bookscape online retail store and it made sense. Now let's think about adding a coffee shop in the bookstore. Okay. Let me give you the numbers for this coffee shop. I'll cut through the numbers because you've seen enough numbers. Let's assume based on just the cash flows and the initial investment in the coffee shop, the net present value you get is minus 88,000. Bad project, right? And what are we told? Net present value is negative. Don't take the project. But here's where the synergy comes in. By opening this bookstore, let's assume you attract people who otherwise wouldn't have come into your bookstore. And that those customers increase your revenues by 500,000 in year one, growing at 10% a year for the next 4 years. So basically, this is the side benefit you get from opening the bookstore. There are people now coming into your bookstore who are buying stuff they wouldn't have bought. There are my cash flows from the additional customers. The net present value of those benefits is 135,268. The net present value of the cafe standing alone is minus 88,000. If you bring in the net present value of the benefits, the overall net present value of this particular cafe becomes a positive number, but only because I'm counting synergy. Let me ask you a question. This is kind of a side question. When I do the net present value of the bookstore, the discount rate I'm going to use is the cost of capital for a bookstore. When I did the net present value of the online retailing, the discount rate I used was the cost of capital for a book online book retailer. When I do the present value of the cash flows here, right, which is the cash flows of the added sales that I have at the bookstore. This is a cafe. So when I did the cafe, I did the cost of capital at a cafe, cost of capital. But when I do the present value of the benefits I get at the bookstore, what's the discount rate I should be using to discount those cash flows? What's the rule in discounting? Yes, Roy. Why the three businesses? The cash flows are to one of the businesses, right? Why not just stick with that business? Well, the risk here is still the book business risk, right? The new customers are coming in because of the cafe, but once they leave that coffee shop, they walk through their door into the bookstore, they're now book customers. Right? The fact that they came in because of the cafe is just the way I got them into the bookstore, but now that they're in the bookstore, the discount rate I should be using should be the cost of capital of being back in the regular bookstore, which I think was 13.something%. That's what you would use to compute the present value benefit. So when you create side benefits, that's always something worth thinking about. Is what is the risk of these side benefits, and what discount rate should I be using to discount those side benefits? Now let me go back to the other investment we looked at. Remember when we looked at Tata Motors acquiring Harman, we concluded it didn't look like a great deal. But we said the reason Tata Motors is acquiring Harman is because they want to put in the state-of-the-art audio technology into their cars, and they hope to sell more cars. Okay? So in my original valuation, the value that I got for Tata Motors was $2.476 billion for the operating assets and $2.7 billion for the equity, and that was much, much lower than the market price. If I stopped right there, it looks like a bad acquisition. But let's assume that it'll take Tata Motors approximately 3 years to bring in Harman's technology into their cars. So it'll take a lag time. You're not going to be able to do it overnight. And once they do that, they'll be able to generate 10 billion rupees more in after-tax operating income from year four on because they'll be able to sell more cars. Not their better audio systems. Right? That cash flow, I'm going to assume, is going to grow 4% a year in Indian rupee terms. So there's synergy. The synergy is showing up in the Indian automobile companies. The cash flows are in rupees. So let's see how we'd value this synergy. This synergy has nothing to do with Harman Audio. So I can't use their cost of capital. If you remember, I computed cost of capital for Harman Audio. This synergy has nothing to do with them. This is an automobile cash flow synergy. Okay? So for my business risk, I'm going to start with the levered beta that I estimated for Tata Motors as an automobile company. Is everybody clear on why I'm doing that? Because the cash flows are to the automobile business. For the risk premium, I'm going to assume that these add-ons are going to be primarily in the Indian cars. If they told me that it was going to be India, China, and Europe, I'd have used a weighted average of that. My equity risk premium that I'm going to use will be the additional risk premium, including the Indian country risk. And for the debt ratio, I'm going to stay with Tata Motors debt ratio because the cash flows are accruing to them. So notice how my focus changed. When I valued Harman Audio, I valued it entirely using Harman Audio numbers. Their debt ratio, their cost of debt, their equity risk premium, their beta. But now I'm valuing synergy. I'm actually looking at how much Tata Motors is gaining from it. That cost of capital in rupee terms is 13.63%, which if I value the synergy, gives me a value of 103 billion rupees. That's 3 years from now. I have to wait 3 years. The value of 103 billion in 3 years has to be the present value of 103 discounted back 3 years, which gives me a $70.7 billion value for my synergy. Let's convert into US dollars. At the exchange rate at that point in time, which was 60 rupees to a dollar, that gave me synergy value of 1.179 billion. I'm still way below where I need to be because if I add the value of synergy onto my original estimated value, the value that I get of 3,857 million is well below the 5,248 million I'll have to pay to acquire the company. So even with the synergy in there, it's not a good deal. So again, when you look at synergy, do it exactly like you do a project. Project the cash flows, think about discounting those cash flows, think about the risk in those cash flows, value the synergy. There's nothing different about valuing side benefits and side costs other than the differences in risk you sometimes can get. Okay. So we're going to close investment analyses by talking about something that sometimes come up in the context of project analyses, but I think it's a pretty important factor that we avoid at our own risk. So what's the rule on capital budgeting again? You do the cash flows, you discount them back, you come up with the net present value. Net present value is positive. It's a good project. Net present value is negative. It's a bad project. But that's what I call a static analysis. Today, that's all it takes. It's a positive. So I want to look at, when you look at a project, three potential options. Here's the first one. Let's say you have a project that has a negative net present value today. It's a bad project today. But I give you the rights to this project for the next 10 years. What does that mean? You and only you can take the project for the next 10 years. Is that right worth some money? You say, why would I want the right to a bad project? It's a bad project today. Could it become a good project a year from now, 2 years from now? Absolutely. Things change, right? Markets change, technologies change. That's called the option to delay. I'm going to talk about how you can use it, think about patents and non-viable technologies. A patent can be useless today, but the rights to that patent, because it gives you exclusive rights, could still make it valuable. Okay? Google, I think, bought all of Motorola's patents for about $3 billion. Most of them were non-viable patents. But they said, you know what? We're buying options. That's the option to delay. Here's the second option. Let's assume you decide to invest $1 billion in India. And you work through the numbers. And the net present value you get for your investment is minus $250 million. You shouldn't do it, right? But let's assume that if you invest in India and the project starts to pay off, you get the option to expand into the rest of India. Huge market. And because you get that option to expand could be worth so much that even though your initial investment has a negative net present value, you go ahead and do it anyway. That's the option to expand. And there's a third option. And this is an option that's always useful to have, both in personal life and in business. You sometimes make bad decisions. Maybe you don't, I do. And when you make a bad decision, it's nice to be able to walk away from your mistakes. It's the option to abandon. So when you take a 25-year project, let's assume in year two you already discovered numbers are not looking good, this project is not going to look good. You're not stuck with this project for the remaining 23 years. You might have the option to shut the project down and walk away, and that's called the option to abandon. And that could make your option more valuable. These three options, the option to delay, the option to expand, and the option to abandon, can sometimes take a project that has a negative net present value today, and you can still take the project. So let's start with the first of these. Yeah, go ahead. So the infrastructure is already half constructed, right? The money's been spent, right? Were you the one who did the construction, or are you thinking about buying this half constructed project? Okay. Were you the one who spent the money, or are you looking at buying this half constructed project?
I believe, like, consider a case where a company built that building.
Right. Well, there are a couple of ways you can do it, right? We could sell the land, the property to whoever will buy it, even if it's well below what you... So let's say you invested $500 million for this half-constructed apartment building, and somebody offers you $150 million. Given that your expectations have come down so much, $150 million might be a great deal. I don't know whether you even looked... I know you probably didn't, so I'll pull the numbers up. But 2 weeks ago in the Weekly Puzzle, I talked about an investment that Chevron made in Australia, off the coast of Australia, in 2009. And here's what they did. They invested in this huge gas plant that cost $54 billion. $54 billion. In 2009, when oil prices were twice what they are today, that gas plant just came into operation last week, when oil prices and gas prices had dropped by 50%. Today, if somebody came up to Chevron and offered them $20 billion for that project, you know what they should do? Take it in a minute. What you originally spent is no longer an issue. And the same thing is true. We have a half-constructed project, and you say, look, this is going to be a terrible investment for us to complete it. You might be better off selling it for half what you paid for it just to get out. That's the option to abandon.
And do companies sometimes just abandon the
project? Oh, absolutely. Well, abandoning the project basically means you get the best you can. If nobody will buy that, let's say you have a nuclear power plant, there's been a leak in it. Nobody's going to buy that empty white building with radiation in the insides. You might actually be willing to pay money to shut it down just because you want to get out of it. Right? So but it's tough to do because you've spent the money, right? You don't want to write it off. But at the same time, that goes back to the heart of sunk cost, which is you cannot put good money after bad money. It just makes it worse. You have to be willing to walk away from your mistakes.
And companies
often like, criticize for working with governments like creating in two and a half way. Like, can you tell us about how public relations? Well, you build a toll road halfway and it goes to nowhere and you leave it. It's kind of bad, right? Well, I think part of the reason is, why did they leave it? Because they were made promises up front about what they could get out of the toll road and halfway through. So don't take the blame off governments on this, because when you talk especially about infrastructure, the biggest reason for abandonment of infrastructure investments is somebody changes the rules in the middle of the game. So they were told, this is the toll road, you'll be allowed to build the toll road, you'll be allowed to charge $100 or $10 for every car that goes in. That was the old government. New government comes in and says, no, that's too high. You'll be allowed to charge only $2 a car. The company says, I can't finish building this toll road. I'll never cover the cost. So I think lots of reasons why the game changed. But infrastructure, the biggest reason is the rules change on you midway, and you're going to say, I'm not going to stick with this. Somebody back there had a question? No? Have you seen options in any of your classes yet? You know how an option works? Classic listed call option. Somebody tell me how a call option on a stock works. What do you have? What do you get with a call option? Then to back up, do you buy at a certain price or you get the right to buy at a certain price? Okay, the right to buy at a certain price. Okay, and what happens if the price drops? It's a right, it's not an obligation. That's the difference in a futures contract and an options contract. In a futures contract, you're obligated to buy at that price no matter what. In an option, you get the right to buy at a fixed price, and that's a huge difference. The best way to think about options is with what's called a payoff diagram. Even if you've never seen options, hang in there, because a payoff diagram is going to go to the heart of what makes an option. So let's assume you have the right to buy at a fixed price, right? That's called the strike price. If the actual price exceeds the strike price, dollar for dollar, you make profits. So if you think about the upside, you make profits above the strike price. If the price falls below the strike price, you don't have to come up with the money, so you lose whatever you paid for the option. When you look at an option, the payoff diagram reflects that. See the kink at the strike price? Above the strike price, dollar for dollar, you make profits. Below the strike price, you lose a certain amount of money, whatever you paid for the option. Now let's bring that into the context of a project. You have the right to take a project. I've given you the right. It's not an obligation. You can take this project any time over the next 10 years for $1 billion. That's what you will need to invest to take the project. Today, it's a bad project. So over the next 10 years, what are you hoping will happen? That the cash flows will go up, that the present value of the cash flows will exceed $1 billion. And if that happens, you're going to take the project and you're going to keep the difference. So if the cash flows go to $1.2 billion, you're going to take the project at $1 billion and keep the difference. What happens when the project gets worse and worse over time? Then you just say, look, I had a right. It was a useless right. I'm going to write it off. Now do you see why there's an option in here? And when you have an option, that essentially means that you have to think about this investment like an option. What does that mean? Up till now, whenever I've talked about risk, it's been a bad thing, right? It reduces value. Higher risk means higher discount rates. Higher discount rates mean lower value. When you have an option, risk becomes your ally. It's the only asset in finance where having higher risk makes you more valuable. Why is that? Why is risk your ally with an option when it's your enemy with any other kind of asset? Take a look at the payoff diagram. You'll see the answer. Why is risk your ally? But that's always true, right? With any asset, but complete the story. What kind of risk do you worry about? Upside risk or downside risk? It's downside risk, right? What have I done with the option? I've protected you on the downside. The most you can lose. So now you can see why risk becomes your ally. So if you have the rights to a project, you want the rights to a project in risky businesses, not in safe businesses. I'll give you a right to a project in a safe business. What does it even mean? But in a risky business, you can see how the right to having a project can add value. This is called the option to delay, and it's actually a great way of thinking about why you can have a bad project today but be willing to pay a high price for the rights to the project. Why you can have a non-viable technology today and actually be willing to pay for the rights for it. I'll tell you a story to bring home this optionality. So an old story, go back to the late 60s, early 70s. RCA, at that time a technology company, made TVs and came up with this new product. And I'll describe the product, and some of you are so young you might not even not recognize the product I'm describing. They came up with this big box that you could put tapes into. And then you could watch movies on your TV. The original VHS technology. And at RCA, when they came up with this technology, when they did the capital budgeting, they decided that nobody would buy this product. Why? Because what are you going to watch? The demo tape that came with the product over and over again. Remember, this was before the days of, you know, tape rental stores. So they did the capital budgeting, and they came up with a negative net present value. And you know what? In 1970, that was probably the right assessment of this project. It was not a viable technology then. That's when they made the fatal error. Whoever did the number crunching at RCA looked at the net present value and said, this is a negative net present value project, therefore it's worthless. So if anybody offers us money for this technology, we'll just sell it to them. So about a year later, Panasonic approaches RCA and says, we heard about this technology you came up with. We know it's useless, but we like to waste money. So we'll pay you a couple of $100,000, it does actually a little more, $2 million, just give us the technology. And you can see the people at RCA laughing behind their hands. Do these people realize how negative the net present value was? And they sell the rights to the technology to Panasonic for a pittance. The rest, as they say, is electronics history, right? Because through the 70s you had, you know, Panasonic and Sharp come up with the VHS tapes and Sony with the beta tapes, but obviously this business exploded. Everybody wanted to make VHS tape players, including RCA. The only problem was they no longer had the technology. So they had to go to Panasonic and pay five times more than what they sold the technology for every year as a licensing fee to produce something that they had owned already. This is the problem when you let geeks set policy. Everyone goes, oh, nobody will buy this. Or everybody will buy this and nobody wants it. That's, you know, the Google Glasses problem. Okay. Next time you use a mouse on a computer, where was it invented? Who invented that? Because everything before that was keyboard driven. Where was the mouse invented? Anybody know? It wasn't Apple. It was actually at Xerox in the mid-70s at a lab called the Park Lab that used to be in Silicon Valley. Xerox at that time was this technology company. So they come up with this technology and people say, who'd use this stuff like this when you can do fun stuff like type in delete, star, you know, all the neat stuff you can do on the keyboard. This is geek thinking. Everybody wants to type that neat stuff now. The MS-DOS commands that people used to use. And they actually had two visitors, two guys whose first names were both Steve. You know who they were, right? Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak visited the Park Labs. They said, this is neat. And Xerox was so sloppy, they didn't even patent the technology. They said, nobody will want this stuff. So Apple actually produced the first mouse, and Xerox sued. The court said, did you guys patent this? So we invented this, but we forgot to patent it. Sorry. And to show you that people never learn, Apple, in fact, ended up creating the Windows interface and then ended up having to give it away to Microsoft and create, you know, you know what I mean by the Windows interface, the original Windows interface before Windows stole it. Okay? But this is what happens when you look at things on a static basis. Something that is not viable today, the rights to it can be valuable because you're getting an option when you do this. That's why when you look at patents, you have to think about that optionality. I'll tell you the other place where the option to delay kicks in. I was in Canada last, as I said, 2 weeks ago, and a lot of Canadian shale oil companies are now underwater. What I mean by that is, they're not physically underwater, but most of their reserves require oil prices to be $50, $55, $60 a barrel to break even. So if you look at their reserves today, from a net present value perspective, you're going to conclude these reserves are worth nothing. Why? Because it, you know, oil prices have to be $55. They're right now only $38 or $39. Therefore, these reserves are worthless. What are you missing when you do that? These reserves are useless today at today's oil price. But if I sold these reserves to you and you were able to sit on them for the next 15 years, hey, maybe 3 years from now, oil price will go back to $75 a barrel, in which case these reserves become viable. If you're a natural resource company, that natural resource reserve is really an option. So when you think about projects, sometimes you might have to think past the static. Today, so if, let's say you conclude Netflix Studio today is a bad investment. I'm not giving any hints, so don't go and change your numbers. Let's say you decide that it's a bad investment. That doesn't mean it'll stay a bad investment in perpetuity. It's a bad investment based on what you know today that could very quickly change 6 months from now or a year from now. So that's the option to delay. Let's talk about the option to expand. Again, I'm going to give you an example. Let's assume you work for Marriott. You've never had hotels in China before. You decide to open 10 hotels in China. And you're the number crunchers. You crunch the numbers on these hotels, and given what you know, you conclude that the net present value of opening these 10 hotels is negative. It's a bad investment. But let me add to this case. Let's say you open the hotels in China. Even though the expected value is negative, let's assume that they start doing really well, much better than you expected. This is where the interesting part of the story kicks in. If they do much better than expected, let's assume you plan to open 100 more hotels in China. You haven't made that decision yet, but if the 10 hotels work well, you're going to use that knowledge you gain for opening 100 more hotels in China. The first investment is a bad investment, but it gives you a chance to get to the second investment, which could be a good investment. That's called the option to expand. And if you think in terms of option pricing mechanics again, whatever you would have to invest in those 100 more hotels becomes your strike price. You will do it only if the information you're getting on the first 10 hotels leads you to believe that it makes sense to open those 100 hotels. And if not, what do you lose? What do you lose if you never expand? That initial 10 hotels were a bad investment, remember? That's a negative net present value. That becomes the cost of the option. This is one way to explain why markets like India and China attract companies. You could go in expecting to lose money, but what keeps you in those markets? The size of these markets is so big that the option to expand becomes the key to understanding why companies do what they do. Which brings me to what to do about existing investments. And this goes back to the question. You have taken an investment, it's already in the ground. So far we've talked about investments going forward, right? Will you take this investment, this new investment? But often you have investments on the ground. Let's see what you can learn by looking at those investments. There are two reasons to look at existing investments. The first is a postmortem, to see how the actual numbers came out relative to the expected numbers. So if you decide to open Netflix Studio, 5 years from now, I can look at the revenues, I can look at the expenses to see how close I'm coming to my expectations. That's the first reason. But there's a second, more forward-looking reason, which is if you think about every investment, you have a choice with that investment of continuing with that investment, stopping that investment, or just shutting it down. So we're going to talk about what you can do about existing investments. And to do this, let's set up an investment. Let's assume it's a 10-year investment, but you're now 2 years into the investment. So you've already made the analysis. You chose to take the investment. You're now 2 years in. The F0, F1 were the numbers you originally forecast for me to take the analysis. These are the actual numbers that have come in. Okay? So the actual numbers can be higher or lower than expectations. So think of the F subscript numbers as your expected numbers the original time. Now you've got the updated information. Based on that updated information, you come up with new forecasts for the remaining 8 years of the cash flows. Will those new forecasts be higher or lower than your original forecast? It'll depend on what the actual numbers were for the first 2 years. The actual numbers came in twice your expectations. You're going to push up your forecast for the future. If they came in below expectations, you might reduce your forecast for the future. You're saying, who cares? Here's why it matters. If you ask me, should I keep going with this investment into the future, all I care about are the future cash flows, not the original forecast, but the updated forecast. So if you look at the postmortem, you're looking at the last 2 years, but we look at the future, it's always going to be based on future cash flows. Okay? So I'll give you an example again. Right? If you think about any project and you look back and you look at that project, I gave you the example of the Chevron, and you look at why did that project, let's say it's a project that's gone bad. There are two reasons projects go bad. One is things you can't control. Chance, luck, fate, world works against you. That I can't blame you for. So in the case of Chevron, what can I not blame them for? I can't blame them for the fact that oil prices have dropped. That's not fair. Nobody knew they were going to drop. So to go back to 2009 and say, find me the analysts who came up with the project, fire them all because they didn't see the gas price dropping 50%. That's not fair. But some of that failure in that project, you can attribute to the analysts. Let me explain. When they originally built this gas plant, they expected the cost to be $35 billion. That was the original cost. The actual cost came in at $54 billion. This has nothing to do with oil prices or gas prices. Somebody screwed up when they forecast the original numbers. That has to be traced to the analysts. Not so because you want to fire them, but you want to make sure this doesn't keep happening on project after project after project. So one reason you look back is to see why did my project fail. The other is to find out from those past projects, what am I doing badly over and over again that I need to fix going forward? And that's the bias issue that you're going to fix. So here are the choices you face when you look at an existing project. And you can think about that half-constructed building. First is you can liquidate the project. Basically, just scrap it, get whatever you can sell. The second is you can terminate the project. Stop it right now, even though there might be no cash flows. The third is you can divest the project. Maybe somebody will sell you, or will pay you to take the project off your hands. And the fourth is to continue the project. So four choices: liquidate, terminate, divest, or continue. Which one you do will depend on what the present value of the future cash flows are. If the present value of the future cash flows are less than zero, in other words, to continue the building and to finish the toll road, you're going to end up with negative cash flows forever. You're willing to walk away and saying, even if I get nothing from this project, it's better than ending up with negative cash flows. So that's liquidation, lowest threshold. If you have a salvage value that you can get from just breaking up the project, selling it in pieces, then you're going to terminate the project. If there's somebody out there willing to pay you a higher price than what you would get from running the project, then you should divest the project. But if there's nobody out there who's willing to do that, and the net present value, the present value of the future cash flows is positive, then you should continue the project. In the case of Chevron, it's true, this is a bad project. I wish they hadn't taken it, but it's too late now. It's already on their books. Whether they should continue or not from this point on will be based on gas prices today and whether I think the cash flows in this project will exceed the costs of producing those cash flows. If that's there, I'm going to continue the project. So let's close with an example. How many of you have been to the California Adventure theme park in Disneyland? Right? So if you've never been to Anaheim, it's actually a very compact theme park. Unlike Orlando, which goes miles and miles and miles, Disneyland is compact. There's this brick separation between the two theme parks. On the right is Magic Kingdom. On the left is California Adventure. Magic Kingdom, of course, is the oldest of the Disney theme parks. That was the theme park that Walt Disney built in 1956. And for a long time, it was the only theme park in Anaheim, than Magic Kingdom. So in 2001, so not that long ago, 15 years ago, Disney decided to open California Adventure. California Adventure is a very unusual theme park. A lot of rides, more like a Six Flags in terms of how it's set up. So it was designed to appeal to older people. Not older people as in 85-year-olds, but older people than 7-year-olds. Wanted to go to Magic Kingdom. And the original idea was they thought that for every 100 visitors who went to Magic Kingdom, 60 would cross over and come into California Adventure. So the original project analysis was based on that prediction, that 60% of the visitors would come to California Adventure. So this is in 2001. They open the theme park and they watch, as Disney always does to that. And it turned out that by the time you got to 2008, out of the 15 million people who were coming to Disneyland, only 40% were coming to California Adventure. And as a consequence, the cash flow they were getting was about half what they thought they would get. So originally they built the theme park expecting 100 million. That had dropped to 50 million. So they were faced with a question. What do we do now? You can't go back and say, let's fix the numbers in 2001. It's too late. So here are the choices they face. One is, say the 50 million is not enough. We're going to shut it down, make it a parking lot again, which is what it was before the theme park was built, okay? And recover whatever you can. So let's say you get a half a billion back if you did do that. The second is, continue with the status quo, which means you're going to continue to make 50 million going forward, the 40% coming through. The third is, to try to put new rides into California Adventure to try to get 65%. And that's basically what they chose to do. They chose to invest another $600 million in new rides, saying, if we do that, maybe we can increase from 40 to 60%, and that will increase our cash flows from 50 to 80 million. So here you are in 2007. You have to decide what's best for Disney. So if you shut the park down, you're going to make $500 million. If you continue with the theme park as is, you're going to make $50 million growing at inflation rate maybe over time. If you put another $600 million in, you can increase the cash flows. Let's see how you'd make this decision. If you continue with the existing business, status quo, doing nothing, you're going to make $50 million growing at the inflation rate of 2%. If you remember, 6.62% was the cost of capital theme parks. The present value that I get is $1.1 billion. So just continuing with the theme park delivers $1.1 billion. If I shut the theme park down, I make only $500 million. Already that choice becomes easy. I'm not going to shut the park down. I'd rather continue over shutting down. Let's look at the third option, though. In the third option, I'm going to increase my cash flows by $30 million, right? From 50 to 80 million. The present value that increases is $662 million. But it's going to cost me $600 million to be able to do this. So should I expand or not? Expanding creates $662. Cost of expanding is $600 million. I create $62 million in additional value. So at least in hindsight, it was the right thing for Disney to do. 4 years later, though, they were still getting only 50% of the people rather than 60. They put the cars right. If you remember, that was another $250 million that they invested. 4 years later, they're still at 50%. Now they're investing in the Star Wars ride, which I think is going to cost them another $500 million. At this point, you probably have to ask, maybe there's too much bias in this process. Maybe they've invested so much in this theme park. After all, it was Bob Iger who made the decision 4 years ago. He's still the CEO. That maybe they've lost perspective here in terms of throwing money in. Maybe you will never get to 60%. So, but this is, I think, the key to looking at projects, is not get stuck in your past decisions. Always look forward and say, what's the best thing I can do for my company based on where the company is today? So it took us a long time. We have the first principle in corporate finance done. Investment decision, invest in assets and earn a return greater than the minimum acceptable hurdle rate. We already talked about what that hurdle rate should be. The hurdle rate should reflect the riskiness of the investment, measure of the beta with equity and a default spread with debt, and should reflect the mix of debt and equity, those weights in the cost of capital. The return should be based on cash flows. Why? Because you can't spend earnings. Should reflect when the cash flows come in. That's why we do discounting. And should have all side effects built into it. Side benefits and side costs should all be in there. That's the biggest part of corporate finance. If you get the investment decision nailed down, you got half of running a business down, perhaps even more than that. Any questions at all about capital budgeting or hurdle rates? I know you don't have your second packet, but I'm going to at least get the process started. I kind of gave you advance warning, but I didn't give you too much advance warning. So if you don't have it, don't worry. Okay? Has anybody gone to the bookstore? Is this packet available in the bookstore? Okay, good. Perfect. So if you want to buy it at the bookstore, you're welcome to. If you want to download it, you're welcome to. So I want to start on the second piece of this class. So let's talk about capital structure. I'll tell you the biggest challenge in talking about. So in capital structure, what you're talking about is how much should you borrow. And I think the biggest problem, the biggest challenge you face in answering that question is almost all of us are already pre-programmed to think about debt a certain way. Let me explain. Almost every religion in the world, I don't care what religion it is, doesn't think kindly about borrowing. In fact, if you're a borrower, you're viewed as weak and sinful. But God help you if you're a lender, because then it gets even worse. Every religion. And maybe there's a reason for it. People get into trouble borrowing money. Maybe that's the reason religions have been so deeply, you know, built into this. Don't borrow money. And only weak people borrow money, and only sinful people lend you money. And that's the psychological barrier you've got to get over when you start to think about debt and equity. Most of us think about, if I ask you, should you borrow money? For many of you, already guilt starts to kick up. If I borrow money, am I doing the wrong thing? In finance, we're agnostic about debt and equity. You use whatever lowers your hurdle rate. And that's effectively what I want to open this process with. So what we're going to talk about are two separate decisions. One is, what's the right mix of debt and equity? for my company. So we're going to start with that. And the second is, we're going to ask, what's the right kind of debt for my company? So let's start with that first, in making those decisions, let's start with that first question, debt or equity. Okay? Let me set the table first. When you think about debt and equity, I'd like to go back to basics, and we already talked about this. Don't think of debt and equity as what you see on a balance sheet. Here's what separates debt from equity. Debt gives rise to a contractual claim that is tax deductible, and failing to pay it gets you into trouble, right? Equity is a residual claim. Every business uses some mix of equity and debt. If you're a small privately owned business, your equity might be what you invest in the business, your family savings, and debt might be a bank loan. As you get larger as a business, equity might be venture capital money, and debt might be what you still take from the, you know, from the bank or somebody else. As you get larger and you become a publicly traded company, equity becomes common shares, shares outstanding in the market, and debt might become bonds. So if you look at the continuum of companies, every company has debt and equity. What we call those can vary depending on where you are in this process. So what I'd like you to think about as we go through the next few sessions is whenever I talk about debt, don't think of it as something only publicly traded companies take on. That hot dog stand outside has debt. Don't think of equity as just something that publicly traded companies have in the marketplace as shares. It's whatever you've invested in the business. And what we're the question we're asking is, what's that right mix for my company? So within that framework, let's lay out some basic facts about how companies borrow money. So this is actually a very old study. I haven't seen an updated version of it. But actually, it cuts to it brings on the first point, which is the mix that companies use vary across countries. So the way to read this graph is, this is how companies come up with the financing that they need each year. So you look at Canada, about 40% of what they need comes from internal financing. What's that? Retained earnings mostly. The green on top of that is net debt. That's debt issued minus debt repaid. And the purple on top of it is new shares issued each year. So in Canada, it looks about 40% comes from retained earnings, 40% from new debt, 20% from new stock issues. You go to United Kingdom, a little higher percentage comes from retained earnings. Net debt is a little smaller, and new equity is about 15%. Go all the way across to the U.S. This was about 10 years ago, but if you look at the breakdown, what do you see? Well, you have very little retained earnings. You have a lot of net debt. And what's this under? What does that mean? When you have a negative number for new equity. With debt, net debt is debt repaid minus debt issued minus debt repaid is net debt. With equity, it is equity issued minus equity bought back. U.S. companies have bought back so many shares that the net equity is actually a negative number, which means you're digging out of a hole when you think about your cash flows. Again, nothing. I'm not passing any judgments on whether that's good or bad. That's the way U.S. companies, especially over the last 25 years, have looked, is they've actually returned more cash to investors than they've issued in new equity. Here's the second thing that sets the U.S. apart from the rest of the world. If you look at how much of the debt comes from bank loans and how much comes from corporate bonds, the difference is pretty stark. In the U.S., if you look at the breakdown of banks, bank loans and bonds, they're pretty close. There's almost as much money raised through corporate bonds as through bank loans. But if you look at Japan and Germany, far higher percentage of the debt takes the form of bank loans. Which is better, to issue corporate bonds or to borrow money from a bank as a company? Yeah. Okay, so tell me what it depends on. So let's say I'm the bank, he's the bondholder. So what determines, excuse me. It's the same project, right? So let's take a given risky project, right? So let's assume the project risk is given. You've decided to take the project. Now you need money. You can either come to me as the bank and borrow money. You can issue bonds in the market and raise debt. The riskiness of the project is the same. Why? Tell me why I will lend you to at a lower interest rate. Because it's the same risky project, shouldn't we both lend at the same rate? Not really. So tell me what you could tell me that you can't tell the bond market that will let me lower the interest rate. With a bank, you can give me proprietary information, right? You can say the project looks risky. Oh, by the way, we have these three customers who account for 50%, and you can show me, there is stuff you can show me as a bank that you could not show the bond market. So in your case, if you have proprietary information about projects, you might actually find it cheaper to borrow from a bank than from the bond market. Can you think of scenarios where it's better to go to a bond market than to a bank? In many emerging markets, if the only option you have is banks, one of the problems you face is sometimes banks stop lending money. They get scared. There's a crisis. They say 15% for everybody walks in. This happens in emerging markets all the time. You have no option in those markets. You have to borrow from the bank. So depending on the borrower and depending on the circumstances, sometimes it makes sense to borrow from a bank and sometimes it makes sense to borrow from a bond market. But it's nice to have both options. That's the advantage that U.S. companies historically have had that most companies in other markets have not until recently. In the last 10 years, bond markets in Asia and Latin America have exploded, just as they have in Europe. Today, Indian companies issue bonds. 20 years ago, Indian companies, they all went to the bank, and it was a government-owned bank, usually, that you went. You went to the State Bank of India, and they said 12% for everybody, and you took the 12%, even though you knew you were paying too much, because you had no choices. But you see this corporate bond dependence is greater in the U.S. because you have the option of going to the bond market. So with that perspective, let's look at my four companies so I can break down what their debt looks like. And let's see how they're different. First, I listed out the total debt outstanding. If you look at Disney, the market value of interest-bearing debt is about $13 billion. In Vale, it's about $41 billion. For Tata Motors, it's 477 billion rupees, so I've switched currencies. And for Baidu, it's 15 billion Chinese renminbi. The lease debt, Disney has about 2.933 billion. What I mean by lease debt is the present value of the lease commitments, so I've converted that into debt. Vale is about 1.25 billion. Tata Motors has either no lease debt or they're not letting me know that they have lease debt, so I don't know which one it is. And Baidu has about 3.05 billion in lease debt. If you look at the breakdown of debt, for Disney, 92% of the debt is corporate bonds, 8% is bank loans. Vale is 60% bank debt, 40%. If you looked at Vale 10 years ago, 20 years ago, almost all of the debt was bank debt. Increasingly, Vale has shifted to the corporate bond market. If you look at Tata Motors, 62% of the debt is bank debt, 38% is corporate bonds. Again, a shift away from the entire dependence on bank debt you had about 10 or 20 years ago. And for Baidu, all the debt is bank debt. If you break that down by maturity, 49% of Disney's debt is between 1 and 5 years. And I want you to already start thinking, is that the right kind of debt for Disney? How do you decide that? You look at what kind of projects are typical. So start thinking about, would I expect to see more 1 to 5 year debt for Disney? So Disney does have 13% of its debt with a maturity longer than 20 years. Which of Disney's assets do you think needs really long-term debt? The theme parks, we talked about them lasting 35, 40, 50 years, right? So I can see why some of their debt is long-term, but for making a movie, it doesn't really make sense to take a 50-year loan. You're going to see the shorter-term debt. If you look at Vale, 38% of their debt is more than 20 years long. What's a typical project for Vale? Another iron ore mine, right? If that lasts 25, 30 years, again, at least there's a semblance of why you're seeing what you're seeing. If you look at Tata Motors, 58% of their debt is between 5 to 10 years. Maybe typical assembly plant. I'm not sure 5 to 10 years is the right thing. We'll come back and address that. And if you look at Baidu, 69% of their debt is really short term. That actually does make sense, right? Technology company, you don't want them to take 20-year loans. If you look at the currency used for the debt, again, think about, does this make sense? 94.5% of Disney's debt is U.S. dollar debt. Do you remember that the breakdown for the equity risk premium that I gave you for Disney? Does anybody remember what that breakdown was? How much of the revenues they got in the U.S. and how much outside? I'll remind you, it's 82% in the U.S., 18% outside. So when you look at this currency breakdown, your first reaction is that doesn't look right. They should have more foreign currency debt. We'll come back and explore that, but that's 5.5% foreign currency debt. If you look at Vale, 35% of their debt is in nominal riyal, 65% is in foreign currencies, which actually does make sense given the fact that their biggest market is China and they're selling into a dollar-based commodity market. If you look at Tata Motors, 71% of their debt is in rupees, 29% is in foreign currencies. And that might make sense now, but it's increasingly not going to make sense, right? Why? What's the part of Tata Motors that's growing the fastest? Jaguar Land Rover. And as it gets bigger, you'd expect to see the foreign currency debt become a larger portion. But here's the biggest puzzle. Where does Baidu operate? Almost entirely in China. All its cash flow should be in the domestic currency. It has 82% of its debt in foreign currency debt. We'll come back and say what might be going on here, but clearly that doesn't make sense. But already you're starting to lay the foundations for asking the question, is this the right debt for the company? Maybe there's a really good reason you borrow in a foreign currency, but we have to come back and examine what those reasons might be to give a pass to a company. And then finally, I looked at how much of the debt is fixed rate and how much is floating rate debt. Somebody explain the difference to me. What's fixed rate debt? How does it work? Yes, right. Go ahead. In other words, I borrow at an 8% rate for the next 10 years. It's a fixed rate debt. Most bank loans are fixed rate loans. What's floating rate? How does floating rate debt work? Want to try? Floating rate debt. It changes with an interest rate, but you've got to become more specific, right? Because it has to change with a specific interest rate. It used to be LIBOR. That used to be a big... But now that LIBOR's lost to China, it can be connected to the T-bond rate, the prime rate, whatever it is. Some rate that changes out there, your interest rate will change as that rate changes. So that's a big difference, fixed rate or floating rate. And we'll come back and talk about why you might use one over the other. But let's see what it looks like for our companies. For Disney, 94% of the debt is fixed rate debt. About 6% is floating rate. For Vale, 100% of the debt is fixed rate debt. There's no floating rate debt. For Tata Motors, 100% of the debt is fixed rate debt. And for Baidu, about 5% of the debt is floating rate debt. Again, we're going to come back and ask, is that right? Should these companies be using more floating rate debt? And I'll give you a very simple way to decide when it makes sense to use floating rate as opposed to fixed rate debt. So now let's start thinking about how much should you borrow. And this is actually something I mentioned right at the start of this class. I said there's an easy way to do corporate finance. You tell me where you are in the life cycle as a company, and I'll tell you how much debt you should have. Anybody here have a startup that they're trying to build? Come on, you can admit to it. You have a startup? How far along are you? Just idea stage, or you're actually raising capital? Have you spent any money on the startup? You've invested any money? Sorry? Okay. So at some point in time, you will go out to raise capital, right? Should you use equity or debt? Why? Service the debt. So early in your life cycle, you should be almost entirely equity funded. As you mature in what sense? You have a product, you start generating revenues and earnings. Your capacity to borrow money might increase, but you're still going to use primarily equity as long as you're still a high growth company because your cash flows are negative. Why? Because you've got to reinvest all this money to keep going. It's as you get to the phase where you're actually making money, what I call the bar mitzvah phase, where basically people say, hey, you're a grown-up now, you've got to act like a grown-up. That's basically when you say, okay, maybe I can start borrowing money. Your debt capacity starts to open up. But you know what? Initially, as a growth company, when your capacity to borrow money opens up, you fight it. Why? Who wants to grow old? You want to be a young growth company for the rest of your life. So for the initial phase, at least, you choose not to borrow money, even though you can afford to borrow money. At some point in time, though, you will get pushed to borrow money. By whom? By investors. Like whom? Like Carl Icahn and Bill Ackman saying, you need to borrow money. You have the capacity to borrow money. That's how Apple ended up borrowing money, right? Carl Icahn kept pushing and pushing and pushing, and finally Apple said, you're right, we can afford to borrow money. So as you move through the life cycle, your capacity to borrow money increases and your debt capacity increases with it. So one way to think about the companies in your project, remember you have five different companies or six different companies in your particular group, is to actually plot them on the life cycle, very generally. My company, growth company, mature company, then look at the debt ratios they have to see if they match up. They might not, which is actually good because then you can talk about why they've chosen not to match up. But look to see where your company's in the life cycle, and you can pretty much tell me whether it's a company that should be borrowing more money or borrowing less. In fact, I call these transitions you make from one phase to another. Those are the transitions that you start thinking, right? Initially, you go from being a private business to VC, from a VC to a public company, from a public company to making seasoned issues. Each time you transition to a different stage in the life cycle, you have to start thinking differently about the company. So you're a visionary, great when you're a young growth company. But as you become a more mature company, you have to start thinking differently because you're no longer running a young growth company. So let's close with a point that I'm going to come back to. So we'll end with this. As we go through the next few sessions, one of the questions we're going to examine is, how much can you afford to borrow? What's the right debt ratio for your company? And let me be clear, when you talk about debt ratios, you have to be very careful about how they're measured because you look at a service, the way debt ratios get measured varies widely across companies. You can compute debt ratios based on all debt or just long-term debt. You can include lease debt or not include lease debt. You can look at market values or book values. So I'm going to be very clear about what I mean when I say debt ratio from this point on for the next six sessions. When I talk about debt ratio, my debt includes all interest-bearing debt and lease debt, just like I've been using it all the way through. And the ratio that I'm looking at is debt as a percentage of the total market value of the firm, debt plus market value of equity. I'm never talking about book debt ratios. And if I want to say debt to equity, I would be very specific about saying debt to equity ratios. Okay? So when we talk about debt ratios as we go through and say, what's the right debt ratio for the company? This is basically the challenge we're going to face, is what's the right mix of debt and equity in market value terms for my companies, 0%, 10, 20, 30, or 50%. Okay. The next quiz doesn't have packet two, so all you're going to be doing is through the end of packet one. So after the case, we will continue with packet two, but it's not so much for the next quiz, but to keep going. But focus on packet one. So you have everything you need for the second quiz all done. So if you want to start looking at practice quizzes after the case is due on Wednesday, I'll send you the links for the second quiz. There will be a review session. Unfortunately, it has to be on Thursday rather than Friday. I wanted to make it Friday. But Friday, there's something going on all over the school. I don't know what it is. I couldn't get a room anywhere. So it'll be in this room from 12 to 1 on Thursday. I'll remind you again on Wednesday. But on Thursday, there'll be a review session for the second quiz that'll cover everything we do for the second question. Okay?
Still understand that. Okay. You've got two things. You've got the fact you have to pay for the server. You've got an opportunity cost.
You don't have the opportunity cost yet. You have to pay for the server in year six. If you hadn't taken the project, when would you have to pay for the server?
Year nine, let's say.
You got it. So when you put a minus 600 in year one, that's how much you're paying.
Yeah.
What you're saving in year six, you're putting a minus 600. Year nine, you're putting a plus 660 or something, right? That's what you save by not investing in year nine.
Put a plus? Where?
In the year that you'd have normally invested it. By investing in year six.
In what line item?
Whatever the CapEx line item is. Instead of having a negative, you'll reverse the cycle.
And so the money that ends up coming off your cash flows is the opportunity cost.
You get it? Let the cash flows take care of it.
I didn't realize you added it back. That's what I lost.
So that meant the difference will then take care of the time value.
Do you want to make
I will try to make it 12:15. I have to make sure the room is available 12:15, 1:15. As long as I think it is, so I will make it. Yeah, you're right. I will do that. Okay. Yeah.
So when I write your slides, it's actually a graph. So is that what you're looking for in the case as well?
I'm not looking for anything. What did I say about the sensitivity analysis?
Well, there's sensitivity and scenario analysis.
Why? What did I say you need to do that?
Well, look at how does when the assumptions change, how does that affect?
We know exactly how they'll change. You make the subscribers lower, you'll have a lower net present value. So there's nothing I learned by looking at the graph. Right? What I want you to tell me is how you looking at that graph changes your decision or doesn't change your decision. So really, it's not about me. It's what you're asking what if questions on. And then looking at the graph, you have to tell me, does this change your decision or does it leave it unchanged?
Okay.
Right? So it's really not about what do I want to see, because I really don't care. You are the one who has to make the decision. It's how you use the scenarios or what-if analysis or whatever you do to feel more comfortable about whatever decision you arrive at. So if your decision is to accept the studio, what I want you to stop and ask is, what is the thing that worries me the most about this investment? Is it the new subscribers I'm going to get? Is it the growth in the existing subscriber base? Is it my costs? Whatever it is, that's what you want to ask the what-if question on to become more comfortable. Yeah? So if you have a graph, use that graph to tell me how it changes or doesn't change your decision. If you have it, yeah.
Sorry. Can we have multiple graphs?
If you need to ask, you can have as many as you want. If that's what leads you to a better decision, you need. But if after asking the what if on the subscribers, you say, that was the only thing I was worried about. I feel perfectly comfortable. Stop. Don't do more what ifs, because you can do more what ifs. Because you can do a what if in every single variable, right? You can have 16 different graphs. But if 15 of them, you really don't care, right? What if the tax rate changes? You might say, I don't care. It doesn't really affect my decision. It's not a big enough assumption. Or what if working capital is at the end of the year rather than the beginning of the year? No, I don't care. So focus on the big assumptions that you think might affect your decision, and then tell me how your decision changes or doesn't change.
So basically like a risk-reward analysis, right?
It's basically an analysis for you to feel better about a risky decision, because you could be wrong, and you want to make sure that you feel comfortable with whatever work you've done to come to the decision you have. So that's a whole point of asking what if analysis and scenario analysis.
Okay. And that's more like qualitative.
There's nothing qualitative, right? After you do the graph, say, I've looked at the graph and I feel still okay. That's it. Nothing more to say. Oh. Hey, what are the qualitative things can you say? Well, my number of subscribers lowers, my net present value goes down. That's pretty obvious. I know where it is. You can give me break-even points and use that, right? You can say, my growth rate has to be at least 2% higher for my net present value to be positive, and I feel pretty comfortable with that 2%. So if you're going to do break-even points or do qualitative analysis, again, that has to be tied to your decision that you're making as a group.
And then would you expect, like, own research on, like, industry trends?
Don't go outside whatever is given in the case.
Okay. Thanks so much. Last question. So, do you have like a draft guideline for the format of the PDF?
You can do a PowerPoint slides if you want. Whatever you think. Think of yourself as making the judgment. You've got to sell it to the rest of the management team, right? Think of me as the rest of the management team. So use whatever works for you to say, this is our decision. This is how we came to that decision.
Without the industry analysis and stuff, right?
Don't. Yeah. Okay. The only industry analysis you can use is the numbers that I've given in the case. Okay. Don't go outside that, right?
Thank
so
you.
Just stay with that.
Thank you.
Right. You need to talk together as a group on that, right?
What are the options?
What are the issues that you're facing uncertainty about? What are you uncertain about, right?
Which rate to use?
Which rate in what sense? There are only three numbers in your There's a risk-free rate, there's a beta, and an equity risk premium.
Yeah.
So when you say you're uncertain about which rate to use, on which of those three do you feel uncertain? Why did I use cost of capital? Because I use cost of capital in the Disney theme park, but I use cost of equity in the Vale iron ore project.
Because of the finance source. The source of finance.
Because I put the cost of it, the interest expenses and the debt payments into the cash flows. So because I looked at cash flows after debt payments with the iron ore mine, I used the cost of equity. So I didn't get to pick. Once I did the cash flows, I had to pick the discount rate that's appropriate for the cash flows. Do you see what I'm asking you? When you did the cash flows for Netflix Studio, did you do it before debt payments or after debt payments? If you did it before debt payments, you have to use the cost of capital. If you have interest expenses and debt payments in your cash flows, then you have cash.
Okay,
exactly.
Okay. So now, so we just use cost of capital then.
That's. See, I don't know how you did the cash flows, so go back and look at your cash flows. It now depends. It's your option, but then it's been internally, because it's not your option when you're both places. You can't say, I've chosen the option to do cash flows equity and you've chosen the option to do cost of capital. Once you pick one option to do the cash flows, you have to stick with that.
So for the sensitivity problem, does it mean that maybe we'll just change
No, no, no. What did I say about what if and sensitivity analysis? Why do I want you to do it?
Just set three key assumptions.
No, but why do I want you to do it? So you can put it in. Well, already you have the answer to whether it's a good investment before you do the what if, right? So but even before the what if, you already have a net present value. So you've already got the good or bad investment. You now have to make a decision based on the number, right? So why do you ask what if questions? Because you're not certain about your assumptions. You want so whatever what if questions you have to ask should be directed to, will this make my decision a better decision? So think of that as why you're doing the what if. So once you get the net present value, if it's a positive number, it says take the project, right? But you're saying, well, maybe I'm wrong. What is the item that you assumed or I gave you an assumption on that you feel most worried about? Is it the working capital or is it the number of subscribers? So think about that. Focus on that. Ask the what if question on that. And then tell me whether your decision is changing or whether it's staying the same. So everything is tied to the decision, right? So don't just create more tables and more graphs for the what if. Because if you don't use it, I'm not going to use it either, right? In a sense, it doesn't matter to me. So whatever what ifs you ask, make it tie it to your decision on what you decide to do with the company, okay, the project.
Can I make adjustment to your consumption?
Yeah, of course, right? Those are estimates too. The fact that I gave you the growth in subscribers doesn't mean it's a fact. It's an estimate.
Okay.
I could be wrong.
Okay.
So focus on the big assumptions and ask the what if questions around those.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
So I have a few questions as well. So if you're doing cash flows after interest payments, then we should...
And debt and repayments. It has to be not just interest payments. It has to be principal repayments and new notes. You're not done.
So before any debt payments, then we use after cash flow.
Right.
Then in your slides, to get the IRR, you have this kind of discount. How do you get the... How do you compare the IRR?
Just do different discounts, right? So you have the cash flows. Just try 1%, 2%, 3%. No, that's all it is. You could probably automate that function. There's a way to do it, probably, but you'd have to write a macro or something. It's not worth it. It's 10
students. Yeah, it's just if we're doing an estimate, we don't get the same decimal places.
Who cares, right? Because in a sense, as long as it's higher than the cost of capital, you're going to accept it. It's not 12.22% that matters. It's whether the discount rate you get is higher than the cost of capital.
Yeah.
Right? So getting it precise. And